Israel. So thank you very much. Can I start perhaps by the usual thanking the organisers for the invitation to speak? And of course, there was a catch, which was I was asked to say a few general words about concentration. So I'll try to make sure I tie together everything. I hope I have time to bring it round to all the things I wanted to talk about in the beginning. In fact, if I looked a little more carefully at the programme, I might have saved myself some time. I think possibly I'm...
I'm not sure that your microphone is on.
Oh, sorry, is that not... Yeah, this isn't a microphone, really. It's a... No. Okay, let me speak a little more loudly. So for concentration, the starting point has to be... Is that clear? The basic Chernoff... Chernoff inequality about binomial distribution, which I presume is familiar to all. And then a standard tool, which is much used in certainly discrete mathematics, theoretical computer science, would be a case when I have independent random variables and I've got a Lipschitz condition, which is okay, always holds. So you have a function with a... If I change any one coordinate, then I control absolutely the change in the function. Particularly if I change the kth coordinate, there's a bound of ck. Then all I'm doing is assuming independence. My function is strongly concentrated about the mean. So in particular, the probability you deviate by t is something like e to the minus, and I've got a t squared term and a normalizer. So in particular, if my x's happen to be 0, 1 valued, and if f happens to be the sum, then each of the ck's is a 1, and you recover exactly the Chernoff inequality. So this is essentially a Martingale inequality that follows from the Azuma-Hofding approach to proving results. So what I want to do is actually say this has been terribly useful, but of course it's a very strong condition, and it'd be nice to weaken that sometimes and get corresponding results. In fact, it's necessary to do so. So, I'm not sure how successful I'll be with two projectors, but let me leave that on, perhaps. So let me start by extending things a little bit. With essentially the same setup as for this independent, the bounded differences approach. So we've got some random variables, x1 up to xn, but let's not necessarily assume they're independent. They almost always will be in applications, but that's not part of what we'll need. And we've got some suitable function, and everything's measurable and so on. I will ignore all these niceties. There's no difficulties in that for what we'll need here. And I want to do a number of extensions of this idea that I've mainly taken from that particular chapter, sort of instructional chapter I wrote. A lot of it dates back to a paper by Friedman in the 70s that you can trace back, and a lot of the ideas were there already. So the key thing for us will be when you apply a martingale-type idea, which all these things are, of gradually revealing a random structure, we'll be assuming you've already observed certain... So I've observed x1 up to xn as my x1 up to xk minus 1 as my first k minus 1 values. Conditional on that event that I see this, let's look at a random variable which is distributed like the next one, given what you've seen. And then this is the key function we ought to be interested in, to control how much things will vary, which is the expected value of the thing I'm after, which is the chromatic number or something of a graph, conditional on what I've seen and further the next values in x, how much that varies from the original conditioning. So by definition, this has to integrate expected value is 1. Expected value is 0, I'm sorry. But it's how this g, take a y, which is distributed like the next value, how does g of y vary? And by considering different measures of this, we get different approaches to concentration following the martingale approach. So let me keep that one around. And inevitably we have to make a few fiddly definitions, but it's very natural what they ought to be. So for example, given I've seen x1 up to xk minus 1, and I'm interested in x is the next value, this soup says how much, that's the positive deviation, by how much can you go above the old expected value? So I've called that dev plus of your previous observations, or the deviation would just be the absolute value of that, which is perhaps more natural to think about. Two other measures. One will be the range. Given what you've seen over two different possible continuations, how much can your expected value vary? And some of the variance. Given this random variable g of y is sitting there, it's got a variance, of course. That's another measure of how variable it'll be. And they're the sort of fundamental natural measures to get your hand on how variable this next the next step is going to be for you. Then we want a few measures in terms of these. It's not so exciting. The first ones we'll just say, and I've phrased all this in terms of given the vector x1 up to xn, then I look through it and look up the first x1 up to xk minus 1, there's a certain possible deviation as you do the next step. Maximize that over all possible k's. So I'm looking along a particular realization x. That's the maximum positive deviation you ever see, similarly maximum deviation. And two other things which are really perhaps the more important for us. Then my r squared, r is for range, and this is sum of squared ranges. I just add up along this particular realization I see the range over the next thing possible squared. I guess that is from 1 up to n, yes. It's a sum of squared ranges. That's saying something about how variable was the environment you met with this realization x. And similarly for the variance. I'll take a sum of variances as summing along this particular realization the variance of the next step. And then an elementary little integration says, in fact, the variance of the overall thing you're after is no bigger than the expected value of this random variance here. And indeed, if you have independent random variables, all identically distributed, it solves its inequality there. So these are some measures of variability. And I guess I do want to keep the... And essentially, they're... If we're following a martingale approach, they have to be the natural ones to look at, or some of them. And then you get a result that says, if I'm assuming my random variable is x, if the sum of squares, of sum of squared ranges is r squared, if it's always, or almost surely at most, some particular constant r squared, then I probably get a deviation at least t is at most the 2e to the minus 2t squared over r squared. So it's exactly the same as if I said for the bounded differences that you always had a fixed amount. As long as the sum of squares of things was at most r squared, that's the inequality we get. But we can have it sort of piece by piece, as long as along each realization that sum is small. Or indeed exactly the same proof says we don't need to say ahead of time that we know an upper bound on the sum of squared ranges, but if I just pick some constant r squared, which is positive, the probability of my deviation is at most the same term plus the probability you got it wrong and the sum of squared ranges was bigger than you expected. So, for example, saying if you go back to that, I hope is moderately familiar, the bounded differences approach, it says if you wanted to, you could strengthen it by saying, instead of having this vector of Lipschitz conditions, the C1, C2, fixed ahead of time, I could choose it locally. For every possible vector x, you can be local to that. You can choose to be C-Lipschitz, Lipschitz at a particular vector, and choose the constants. As long as you make sure the sum of squares at most that number, exactly the same thing works. Okay, and indeed, perhaps a slightly more familiar... Oops, it's not the one I was after yet. Maybe I will get back now to... Eventually, I want to talk about permutations. And what I want to do is... in particular, consider when I... Oh. Certainly. That's a very sensible request. Here we go. So another result which will follow from that with little difficulty. I guess, I hope that was fairly clear. Why that follows is just because it's along some particular trajectory of x. If I have got this Lipschitz condition, then it's quite straightforward that essentially is saying your ranges have to be small. Similarly, if I look at what I want to get round to eventually, take some permutation uniformly distributed over the symmetric group or in fact other groups, and I'll think of it as, let's think of it represented as always my set's going to be 1, 2, 3 up to n, and I'll think of a permutation as meaning the vectors, sigma of 1, sigma of 2, sigma of 3. And that's the way the representation we think of. So in particular, the distance we'll take between two permutations will just be the Hamming distance between these two vectors, which is exactly the same thing as if I take sigma to the minus 1 tau and look at which points are fixed and which points move. It's just exactly the number of points that move, which is the degree of a permutation, size of its support. Then, again, from that result, we get quite easily the fact, if I take something uniformly over the symmetric group, and suppose I've got a Lipschitz condition on a function, and in particular we will ultimately be interested most of all in longest increasing subsequence, but let's just keep it as a general function just now. So, again, Lipschitz condition, this is most the distance. Then we'll have a strong concentration result. The probability of your random value differs from its expectation by more than t. It's got exactly the usual form. And that follows exactly from here, where the x's aren't independent, of course. I could take it as independent. Let's leave it. This was one of the original Martingale applications by Mori, which sort of set the ball rolling in the discrete mass world for using these results.
Thank
you. And I was going to say more on proving it, but I think I'll skip that because it. Okay, so that was essentially taking the bounded differences approach and extending it. Exactly the same way you can extend the Bernstein's theorem gives an inequality, a concentration result in terms of variances. And let me just assume for a minute that you've got the same setup. I've got independent random variables, say, and what I know is... Well, in fact, they're not necessarily independent. Somehow I've managed to control this. And I know my big V, my random sum of variances, is no more than some value little v. And if I also know the maximum positive deviation I ever get, I should only need to go upwards. If I know that's no more than some number b, so if we control both these things, then we get a concentration result of this form. And if you don't know it, in the same way, you can just add on a condition that says, well, I got that wrong. There's also a probability that my sum of variance was too big, or that the maximum deviation was too big. And possibly I could have saved this bit of introduction because this is very much at the heart of the Kim and Vu's work on his concentration polynomial methods and concentration for functions that are not nicely Lipschitz, but you can average out and become Lipschitz. I think I'll skip the next application. Convey me. A lot of these results, really, we could look back to Friedman, I think. Now, one quick comment, just to say that these results, essentially, they're all... Nobody mentioned the word martingale. Well, I did mention the word martingales, but they're all martingale results, and they're most naturally proved that way. So, for example, that last one, we just... has got a martingale version in exactly the same way. Okay, so now if I can get back to... increasing sequences and so on. So I guess we don't really need this one, I think. So suppose we've two ways of approaching it. One would be to suppose I've got n random variables, independent, identically distributed with some continuous distribution. For example, uniform and not one. And I look at the maximum length of an increasing subsequence. Or I might want to think of it as pick a random permutation uniformly from the symmetric group on 1 up to n, and again think of it as a vector and look at the length of the longest increasing subsequence, and they're identically distributed. And for one, I've got fully independent things to play with, which is nice. And what the other one, well, I'm picking from the symmetric group, which is pretty easy to handle too, though. So either way round, we can get some concentration results. But if we look at what we've done so far, that bounded difference, as one said, looking at the independent case, whenever I flip the value of one particular coordinate, of course, the maximum length of an increasing subsequent changes by at most one. So all my c's are ones. So I get e to the minus 2t squared over n. That's the sum of c key squared. Or the Mori-type result, thinking more in terms of working in the symmetric group, is identically the same bound by a slightly different method. But, of course, that turns out not to be terribly useful for us because what we know is that the average value and the median value, all these things are about 2 root n, in fact, concentrated a little bit around 2 root n, whereas these things only start to cut in when t is bigger than root n, and so we've learned nothing, really, from these particular approaches. So that's sort of take one for increasing subsequences. So, and we'll... There's very precise... There's very, very precise result. You can read that, isn't it? Yes, there's precise asymptotic distributions, yes. And it... Yeah. No, it's very well known. In particular, you said there's an asymptotic distribution, and indeed there's large deviation results, which we'll come
this
on to.
The reasons, it's within the last 2 years. I mean, it's Dived and
Bake.
Bike.
No, I'm not talking about asymptotic distribution. I'm looking larger at large deviations, but that's also fully known, and we'll come on to that. But as part. So to some extent, we're looking at something which is fully sorted out, but I want to look at the general method and how well it approaches it, how well it handles these things. Okay, so particularly we've used this h of x as the maximum length of an increasing subsequence, and I'm back to independent random variables just now. So I'm asking, how concentrated is this? As you said, we do know some results, but... But let's just observe some simple things, because we want to be able to apply these to quite robustly when I'm doing various combinatorial algorithms and analyzing them. So two things you do observe: changing a value changes the increasing subsequence length by at most one, and you've got this verification. There's short certificates that says, if the longest increasing subsequence is length s, then I can show you just these s coordinates, and you already know the longest increasing subsequence is length at least s. And that turns out to be the crucial thing, that now that there's two enormous slides I've got, so this is one of them. But that property over there of increasing subsequence is exactly the property for which an inequality from Talleyrand, Michel Talleyrand, works. So in particular, if I start with all independent random variables, I've got some constants lying about, and my function h satisfies, first of all, a Lipschitz condition that says, the same as our usual one, changing any variable can change the value by at most 1, or let's say at most b. We can always rescale things. But then we have the certificate condition that says, if your value is some number s, then in order to prove it's at least that value, we need only look at a certain number of coordinates, and let's take a linear vector, so some constant number times the actual value s. As long as I've got that, one of several of his inequalities, from that you can deduce concentration about the median, which is a nice strong form that we should think of B as being, these two numbers, B and R, as being ones or twos or something. They'll be fixed at very small numbers throughout all applications. I think all applications I'm familiar with, they're small numbers, so you just think of them as small constants. So this is about e to the minus t squared over m plus t, and so this is about t squared over m again. So now that t is of the order of epsilon m, we have about e to the minus something times m for both of these tail bounds. So in particular, if I keep that, so in particular, what that says for our increasing subsequence, that our constants can be just, the B is 1 for the Lipschitz condition, the R is 1 for the certificate condition. So we get exactly what I was saying, that the probability that we, both for the chance of going upwards, the upper tail and the lower tail, we've got the same symmetric, well, nearly the same bound, which look like constant times the median here. And the median almost is something like root n. And that follows straight out from that Talleyrand inequality. Now, that's been a nice improvement from Boucheron, Lugosi, and Massart, which essentially gets to the same result, but nicer constants and a clean treatment, which I guess I won't say much more about. Since the natural way they prove it is using inequalities from information theory or these Log-Sobolev inequalities that turned out, well, two takes on the same thing, really. But they end up naturally, out falls the nice constants, essentially epsilon squared over 2 times mu, which is what you might, well, it comes out cleanly. So that looks nice, both tails, again, the same sort of behavior. But neither of these have got it right. Because if I ignore the fact we know about asymptotic distributions, we also know about tails. And there's nice large deviation results by Deutschel and Zaituni. Much more precise than this, but they're saying that when you're looking at the upper tail, which says the probability that you get a longer increasing subsequence than you might expect, we've got it about right. In other words, it does die like some constant times m, the root n. But you look at the lower tail, the probability you fail to get a big increasing subsequence is very, very unlikely. And it's actually an n in there, not a root n. So we've learned a lot that from the Telegrand inequality is really telling us some good concentration, but it's not getting the full story. But we're still, this is a big improvement over what we knew before from the martingale approach. So very, very quickly. And what I called Telegrand's inequality is really a version, a particular corollary from one particular inequality of his. And just to describe what that the basic inequality that it came from, we did this notion of convex distance, and that's something to distance between a point and a set. So we take I look in some n-dimensional space. I take a point x in the space and a subset a of the space. And the first thing we look at is the set u of ax, which is a whole of 0, 1 vectors. And there are those vectors such that if I start from x and I only change coordinates where I see a 1 in my vector y, then I can get into the set A. So the all possible places I can do changes. And then further, this is sitting inside Rn, just zeros, ones. If I take the convex hull in the normal sense, I call it V of Ax, then the convex distance is the actual ordinary Euclidean distance from the origin into this convex hull, or there's the minimum norm of a vector in this convex set. So that becomes a distance from a point to a set. There's a dual or equivalent way of looking at that that says, if I give you a non-negative vector alpha, this d alpha, there's a notion of the alpha Hamming distance between two vectors. It just says you look at the vectors, look at where they differ, and add up the corresponding alphas, and that's your penalty, that's your distance. If I call that d alpha between y and x. And then if I define the d alpha, the natural thing, once I've got a distance, there's a normal metric, the d alpha. If I there's a d alpha distance between a point and a set, will then be, as usual, an int for a minimum over all points in the set of the distance from where you are into the set. And that doesn't add so much to Hamming distance, we've just rescaled things. But it turns out the Telegrand's convex distance is the supreme over all possible choices of the alpha. So you're making life as hard as you possibly can for yourself. All possible choices of alpha of a given size, we scale it so the norm is 1 of this Hamming distance. So his results are phrased in terms of this convex distance. Just to get another picture of it, if my underlying space happens to be 0, 1 to the n, which for combinatorialists it usually is, then the convex distance is just exactly the distance, the Euclidean distance from your point to the convex hull of the set you started with. So it's a more refined measure of distance than a simple Hamming distance. Okay. And where the inequality we just had concerning with the Lipschitz condition and a certific condition, that follows quite easily, fiddling around, from this particular theorem, which says if I start with independent random variables, I've got some subset A, and I take my random vector, my random point x, and this is saying that that product is always small, that the probability x is an A times the expected value of something to do with the squared convex distance. And to get some meaning from where we always use it, is simply use a Markov inequality that says then the expected value is at most 1 over the probability. So using a Markov together with the expected value, so the probability that your convex distance is large is at most some number. In particular, typically the set A will be all those things taking some value up to the median or from the median onwards, and so they're always so big sets of size of probability half. And we get some inequality of this form, and that's where we get, we go from there to the other results that we're talking about. And this has got subject to lots of different proofs now, but typically that the original proof was a clever induction. You do the work in one dimension and do a clever induction. Okay, so far so good. Now, back to permutations and such like, via the motivating application where this came from to begin with. Mention graphs at all, but one of the most fundamental theorems in graph theory, very basic theorems you first meet, says given a graph G, I'm trying to colour it, chi of G is the least number of colours possible to colour the vertices, so the usual rules that two adjacent vertices mustn't have the same colour. Quadratic numbers at most the maximum degree plus one is sort of trivial, you just colour sequentially and you can never go wrong. But the condition says, apart from some little things when you've got degree 2, assuming the maximum degree is large enough, namely 3, there's only one thing that forces you to need that extra plus 1, namely if there's a big clique. This thing, the maximum size of a clique, in other words, the maximum number of nodes which are pairwise adjacent, that has to be no more than the maximum degree plus 1, but as long as it's only the maximum degree, then in fact you can colour with that number. So that's one way of stating Brooks' theorem, and one of many, many extensions from Bruce Reed and Mike Malloy and others to these was this theorem that says, essentially, big cliques are all that can ever force you to need lots of colours. The only time you're forced to use near the maximum degree number of colours is when there's a big clique. So here it's saying, if the largest size of a clique is considerably smaller than the maximum degree, then the chromatic number is also considerably smaller than the maximum degree. And all these results, of which this is a sample, are, well, Bruce will probably tell you more later in the week, but they're only accessible by random methods. Nothing else touches it. And to see the sort of random methods, actually, I'll put that here. I will say rather little because you'll hear about it later, but just to get some idea, and this slide is lying, and I'll get caught out because Bruce will tell you later, but this is essentially the story. And to prove a result like that, you've got to take your graph, and some parts are easy. There's sparse bits where typically look at a vertex, look amongst your neighbours, and there's not very many edges there, and it's easy to colour. But there's hard bits which are very dense, and you can canonically partition up the graph into a collection of dense bits and a sparse bit. And then you randomly construct a colouring with a sort of idea roughly being that all the dense bits, which are something like cliques and are tricky to colour, you deterministically know you can colour it. So if I use colours 1 up to C, where C is considered is the number I'm aiming for, so it's 1 minus something times the maximum size of a maximum degree, we know deterministically they've got colourings. The sparse bit should be easy as long as I make sure I do things randomly and avoid problems. So the overall idea was, for each of the sparse vertices, you just pick a colour at random, uniformly. The dense bits, you daren't, of course, do things deterministically because you'll get in trouble. So you use the deterministic colouring, but then you've got to permute the colours uniformly at random to mix things up and make it field at random. So that's what this is saying. For each dense part, I want a permutation picked uniformly from the symmetric group on these, and I'll just randomly recolour. And then you've got to say, well, that was your first attempt at colouring. If you get some clashes, you uncolour things. And what you want to, in the end of the day, is what's the partial colouring that's left, you want to prove that there's a positive chance that then you can complete a total colouring of the whole graph. So the tool you'll use will be the local lemma, inevitably. And typically you can work out and do expectations if things look right. What you need is strong concentration results. Just, I work out the expected value looks right locally. As long as things are very concentrated, I get probability bounds. I mean, you can use the local lemma. So what we need is, for this sort of setup, where you're throwing in some things at random and you're permuting lots of things at random, we need some concentration results. So that's where we're after. And it's not quite obvious because I've been a bit sketchy, but there's a Lipschitz condition naturally sitting around there. It says if I change the colour in something, well, typically it doesn't hurt too much. Or in one of my random permutations, I say transpose a couple of elements, it won't change things too much. There's a sort of stability. And typically also we can find sort of short certificates of things when things go wrong. But what that means is we might hope to get some sort of telegram type result. And indeed it's true. So there was a fairly packed slide before with all these conditions and the telegram inequality. Now we have the same slide, but we pack in some independent permutations as well, which will correspond, I think of them as the recolouring ones that are going on. And I assume everything in sight is independent. All my random choices of variables, all my separate permutations are all independent. And we have the same sort of lot of conditions. I've got some constants. We've got a Lipschitz condition on the, if I change any of my variables xj's. We have a Lipschitz condition in all the separate permutations. It's if I flip things, for example, do a transposition, it won't change my function value too much. The function was something like the number of a colour is appearing on a neighbour of somebody. And then we also need a certificate condition that says if this function value takes some value, then to prove it hits at least that value, I don't need to show you too many coordinates. And coordinates means values of the x's or values of the permutation. I think of a permutation as a vector, like pi of 7 is 3. That's showing you the seventh coordinate of pi, that particular one. So if I've got all these conditions, it turns out we've essentially got outpops the same sort of inequality as we had before. Probability are much above the median. It's no more than, in fact, these are exactly the same terms, only instead of having a 4 there, it's not quite as good, it's a 16. So let me leave that up and then talk a little more about it. Actually, before I say how we'll use it, let's just mention, because that's the form, the sort of encapsulated form that comes from the basic theorem, which is like Talleyrand's basic theorem, and that's of this form. We'll just say, again, something to do with essentially a probability being in a set, and then expected value of e to something to the squared Talleyrand distance. And that's essentially the convex distance between the vectors, but had to do a little bit of rescaling. And then just observe, if you simply wipe out, presumably, instead of a vector of permutations, there aren't any there at all, that's exactly back to Talleyrand's condition, because there actually was a scaling 2, which cancelled out that 16 and pops it back to a 4. And if I've got no x's, no random colouring on the sparse set at all, I just focus on the random permutations, what we get is a result that says, if I take a group which looks like a direct product of symmetric groups, and I can think of acting on disjoint sets, if we like, and I take a subset of this, so a group to me is, of course, a great long vector, so we think we're representing our permutations as vectors. Take a subset, and I also take a permutation picked uniformly at random from my group, then we have this condition. That's what boils down if I just ignore the x's. Now, it turned out, when I only had one permutation, this is in fact exactly yet another of Talleyrand's inequalities, which he proved separately by the same sort of inductive proof, but a different ideas to the original Talleyrand one we were after. So we had, this was sort of a merging of two different ideas and simplification of two different ideas from Michel Talleyrand. Okay, so where do I want to? So I guess what I should say is that, okay, this you'll see umpteen applications for it in the little advertisement for a book by Bruce and Mike Reed and Mike Malloy, and it just does the trick for many of these colouring algorithms. So essentially, that was what we wanted, to be able to handle certain rather complicated randomized algorithms for colouring graphs, so you could get deterministic results from them. But what it said is a particular, very special structure of permutation group, then we'll get concentration. If I pick something uniform at random from something which is this product form of groups, then things will concentrate. As long as I've got some sort of Schitt's condition or something, we get the usual, exactly the form of the Talleyrand had. Well, they work for symmetric groups, it's nice, it works for these problems. What's making this work? Why are we getting concentration, or what's the property we should be looking for? A little bit, these results are sort of magic because they're inductions that are sort of blind and they work. So you want to try and understand a little bit better why we're getting concentration. And it turns out there's a certain pretty natural property of permutation groups that make this work. And they very sweetly make the Talleyrand proof work, so much so that you think, well, okay, it seems natural. And then I'll say a little bit more about that at the end. But, so this is work, joint work with Malvina Uchak, who's at that point a student in Oxford. So the definition of what will be a nice permutation group to me is this slight mouthful, but not much. So you've got number L. L is 2 or 3 or something. I'll call a group L local. If take any two elements, my underlying set I'm permuting is always omega. Take any two elements I and j from my underlying set, omega. And the condition is, if I and j are in the same orbit, if I can get from I to j somehow, by some permutation sigma, then there has to be an economical way of doing it, which says there has to be some other permutation tau, well, or the same one, which also takes I to j, which only moves points which are moved by sigma. The support of tau is contained, this word of sigma means anything fixed by sigma, you've got a leaf fixed. And further, it only moves a few points, it's at most L points. So that'll be this notion of being local, and it's just to try and get a feeling for what it's saying. A symmetric group is too local, trivially, because if I go from I to j, I've got a transposition that does that. It's not too exciting. If I'm an alternating group, look at all the even permutations of something, will be three local because, well, easily seen. You're full of three cycles. If I go from I to j with sigma, either like sigma itself only moves two things, or it moves at least three, and then you've got some three cycle contained within the support. If I've got a lot of L local groups acting on disjoint sets, then it's pretty trivial checking that that'll stay. If you're all L local, everything stays L local. What else is sort of reasonably obvious? So if I've got a direct product of symmetric groups, well, certainly then just a Dirac two local, so the whole thing's two local, and in fact it's the other way around as well. So that's hard to check. Or I guess intuitively obvious, I hope, anyway. other results. Trivially, if a group acts on only n elements, it's n local. That's just the way the definition works. And there's lots of groups aren't local at all. For example, if I look at a cyclic group generated by something, an n cycle, any permutation there either fixes everybody or moves everybody. So you're not even n minus one local. Well, sorry, you. Do I mean you are n minus one local? Yeah, you're not n minus one local. Okay, you move all n guys if you move anybody. So just to get a little feeling for what I mean by these local groups. Oh. Well, I think I missed one enough here. Really. Oh, yeah, I forgot to add one thing. So when is a group 3 local? Well, certainly so alternate groups are 3 local. As are symmetric groups, they're 2 local, so they're also 3 local. In fact, there's a similar result. Actually, it takes a little bit of proof, but isn't hard. It says a group's 3 local if and only if it's a direct product of either some symmetric groups or alternating groups. Which is sort of tidy, but also it's rather rather sad. It says, well, there's not very many 3 local groups around. They're all there. Oh, here we go. So that's the result is there. But look at, there's an example just to get something to think about. If I've got some permutations of 1, 2, 3 and some of 4, 5, 6 and they're sort of separate except that I insist that the product thing is even, then a little checking, which you can, I hope, do as I'm talking, says this actually won't work. It looks like 3 local. There's lots of 3 cycles and things in there, but it's not 3 local. And in fact, the only 3 local ones are when you really are properly, you are direct products. You know, you take any permutation here together with any permutation on that one. Okay, so, in fact, when you... In a way, I'm not following up the algebra because I guess that's not everyone's cup of tea here, but there are some algebras. There's various results that say it's actually very hard to find interesting groups which are 5 local and so on. But notwithstanding, let's ignore that just now and say the original, the Talagan result extends exactly. That said, if I've got an L local group, pick something uniformly at random from the group, I will have exactly the same sort of inequality, only instead of being, let's start at a 16th when L was 2, I've got some other number here. And in fact, you plug in L's 2 because this becomes a 16th, and L is 3, you've got another constant, with the same sort of inequalities. In particular, if that's the underlying result, there will then be a corollary which says if I've got a Lipschitz condition and a condition also in certificates, so some function defined on your group, and if it happens to be a now local group, you're going to get strong concentration. And in particular, if we go back to our case, I've got some group of permutations on 1 up to n, and I think of, again, as the vector, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 1. I ask about increasing subsequences. Again, as before, we can... Certificates only need to show you the increasing bit, and the Lipschitz condition is a 1. So what that says... I guess I should do it. So if I've got to any L local group, as long as the L is bounded, we get the same qualitative behaviour. For both upper and lower tail, we get the same sort of bound, and they both look like e to the something-something times the median. And what we saw before was, for the symmetric group, that was good on one side and not so great about lower tail. In that context, I'm not sure what we learn exactly, but interesting example of a two-local group. That the Talagan methods extend seamlessly, essentially, to these local groups. And here's an example of a two-local group, which we know exactly the behavior of the longest increasing subsequence. And if I take the group generated by 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, these disjoint permutations, the transpositions, then what's the longest increasing subsequence? And for sure you've got n over 2. You just pick one from each of these, and depending on whether they're in the right order or not, you'll get an extra one. So my longest increasing subsequence is exactly distributed, like n over 2 plus a binomial. So you know the tails, and we know they're symmetric. And of course we get the same bound in each tail. But whether that's actually telling us a little bit about why the Talagan-type methods can't distinguish the tails, I'm still not totally convinced about that. Okay, I should just make one last comment rather than any more slides, which is that this local condition, if we try and go back full circle to where I had the martingale methods, and you look at can I get a concentration result by something like the bounded differences approach, but where I have the bounding the sum of squares of ranges, and you look for the condition that works, well, in fact, it's exactly identical, the same condition does the trick, and you get a same sort of concentration result. But I guess that all must tie the circle together. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Questions? If there are no questions, then we have a great time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Lecture will be in Bucharest at 4:30.